From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and get ready for this Coast to Coast AM ride. Floating format tonight. Well, Hurricane Dean has slowed down to a Category 1, but man, was he tough. Sweeping across the Yucatan Peninsula, toppling trees, power lines, and houses as it bore down on the heart of Mexico's oil industry. Glitzy resorts on the Mayan Riviera were spared, but vulnerable Mayan villages were exposed to the full fury of one of the history's most intense storms. Mexico President Felipe Calderon said that no deaths were immediately reported in Mexico after Dean killed 13 people in the Caribbean. But driving rain, poor communications, impassable roads made it difficult to determine how isolated Mayan communities fared in the sparsely populated jungle where Dean made landfall as a ferocious Category 5 hurricane, dropping down to a 1. Well, sigh of relief here. The space shuttle Endeavour has returned to Earth safely, ending a nearly two-week orbital drama that centered on a deep gouge in the shuttle's belly and an early homecoming prompted by the hurricane. The gouge looks only slightly worse than it did in orbit, said NASA Space Operations Chief. The exposed felt material, the last barrier before the shuttle's aluminum frame, did not char. They are going to take a very close look at all of these protective tiles there. I'm going to try to explain this as best I can. It's very technical, and we're going to have to do a program on this. But an Israeli scientist says he's figured out how time machines might work. A new concept, he says, for a time machine could possibly enable distant future generations to travel into the past. You know, currently, physicists say it's possible to travel into the future, but we don't think you can go into the past. Well, this Israeli scientist is changing all that now. Unlike these past ideas for time machines, this new concept does not require exotic theoretical forms of matter. Still, this new idea requires technology far more advanced than anything existing today, and major questions remain as to whether any time machine would ever prove stable enough to enable actual travel back into time. But the Israeli physicist says this is basically what we do. His latest research suggests time machines are possible without exotic matter, eliminating a barrier to time. He's talking about working with donut-shaped holes enveloped within a sphere of normal matter. So it's pretty technical, but a great story. We'll work on getting a big guest to explain this for us. President Bush has apparently sidestepped a direct question about whether he would be willing to categorically deny that there is a plan to create the North American Union. Instead, he said that those who believe that that is taking place, they are conspiracy theorists. The president made the remarks in Quebec, Montebello, Quebec, as he was meeting with the heads of Canada and Mexico to discuss their latest work on their security and prosperity partnership. Jerome Corsi was there for WorldNet Daily. Jerry, what do you think about all this?
Well, George, it was very strange because the Fox News question put to President Bush was very direct. It served up an opportunity to directly and categorically deny that the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America was in any way going to create a North American Union or promote the building of NAFTA superhighways. And instead of just denying it, saying this is not the case, it's not the agenda, and trying to refute some of the specific claims, such as the funding of the NAFTA superhighway by Centra, the investment consortium in Spain, or the fact that Governor Perry has vetoed all the legislation that the Texas legislator voted almost unanimously. Mm-hmm. What George Bush said was, no, that anyone who would believe any of these ideas was just a conspiracy theorist, and he ridiculed the idea. And the ridicule, George, as you know, is the kind of the final refuge of sophists when they can't answer an argument with logic or reason or argumentation. They simply try to dismiss the argument by ridiculing it, which is an attempt to tell people not to listen to the argument because it's really so damaging that the person like George Bush had no response. That's the logical conclusion when you're ridiculed. It's really that George Bush was conceding the argument because he couldn't refute it.
Did they explain why they even need a security and prosperity partnership of these three nations?
It's a very good question, George. No, it's always presumed that, of course, you know, these three nations need to work together because we're partners, and that's fine. But I could continue to ask the question that I began in the book, The Late Great USA. We're now 6 years into a war on terror. And why is it that George Bush has not yet secured our borders with Mexico and Canada? We've had it admitted, the government admits 12 million illegal aliens who come across the border, three-quarters of them during George Bush's term. That's one out of every 10 people right now living in Mexico or born in Mexico is living in the United States today as a Mexican citizen. By 2010 or 2015, it's going to be one out of every 5 people born in Mexico is living in the United States today will be as a Mexican citizen today with some 40 consular offices from Mexico in the United States to protect their civil rights as Mexican nationals living in the United States. We've already become a dual nation. And George Bush, instead of proposing a solution to this problem, at least building a fence or doing something to secure our border, George Bush has now twice come to Congress with this Kennedy-McCain compromise immigration reform bill, which many call a shamnesty bill, just another form of amnesty. And George Bush has said, well, we can't solve this problem. We can't round up 12 million people and send them home. That's the way that the European Union was created. First, the leaders created a problem that they couldn't solve, and then they came to the countries and said, well, the only way you can advance this agenda, get out of this difficulty, is compromising sovereignty. As Europe went over a 50-year period from a coal and steel agreement 50 years ago, this year, 1957, through a European common market to a European Union with the euro, and our elite and multinational corporations have already named our new regional currency the Amero.
In your book, The Late Great USA, your best-selling book, you talk about how, in using government's own documentation to show the advance of a North American Union and also, of course, this highway, yet there's denial everywhere, Jerry.
Well, you know, George, I wrote the book to be easy to read. It's about 235 pages, and it's got 30 pages of footnotes. Just like all my articles in WorldNet Daily, there's government documents supporting every claim. The footnotes give you the opportunity to go see the government documents yourself. You know, when people actually take a look at the documentation that the Trans-Texas Corridor is going to be built 4 football fields wide, all the obstacles are now out of the way, stretching from Laredo, Texas, right up to the border with Oklahoma. Oklahoma is already under pressure from the investment bankers to extend the highway north. I mean, if people think about it reasonably, the highway is not being built 4 football fields wide to the border of Oklahoma, and the anticipation is just going to stop.
No, it's not going to stop. And who owns the highway?
Well, technically the people of Texas will own it, George, but Cintra, C-I-N-T-R-A, the investment consortium in Spain, which is financing the highway with billions of dollars, will own the operating rights and the toll concessions on the highway.
Isn't the king of Spain?
Yes, Juan Carlos's family is very tied with the Cintra Investment Consortium. It's a Spanish government-related family tie. And Texas will be under non-compete provisions so that I-35 and no other a highway can be built to compete with the Trans-Texas Corridor.
That's amazing. Jerry, keep up the good work for us in the summit, of course, the Security and Prosperity Partnership. It is now over. Is that correct?
Yes, it ended today. It was the shortest of these summits. The three leaders left without spending a full 24 hours together. It was almost like they were pained to be together. And I think the growing pressure of public resistance and opposition to the Security and Prosperity Partnership, especially in Canada and the United States, was telling on both Stephen Harper and George Bush as they answered questions in today's press conference.
Jerry, last question. Are you a conspiracy theorist?
Well, I like to think that the conspiracy theory is the behind closed doors meeting that went on by the Security and Prosperity Partnership with this North American Competitiveness Council. You know, there were 30 corporations that were picked by the chambers of commerce in the various countries, and they got to participate in all the closed door meetings, advancing their no regulations, open border agenda. But not even the press were allowed to sit in on any of those meetings. And there were no public stakeholders, as they call them, or shareholders, or opposition leaders, or labor leaders, or environmental leaders. Only a multinational business agenda behind closed doors in the Montebello meeting of the Security and Prosperity Partnership. That's where I think the conspiracy is, George.
All right. Thank you, Jerry. Jerry Corsi, of course, the author of The Late Great USA. If you go up to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the incredible story, The Glass in the Man's Eye. For 6 years, a Chinese man lived with a large shard of glass hidden under his right eye for 6 years. He's 22 years old. He had the eye injured by a beer bottle during a fight 6 years ago. Doctors finally removed this thing. Take a look at the size of this shard of glass that you can see on the coasttocoastam.com website under Hot Stories. And two Swiss students on holiday played frisbee with an object that they found on a beach. What was wrong with that? Well, they were unaware that this frisbee-type thing was a live landmine. 20-year-old and a 19-year-old took a plunge in the Danube River in Budapest. They found the mine, began their potentially lethal game. A lifeguard watching stopped them and said, "Do you know what you're playing with?" They called police. The bomb squad came and took the mine away. In 1924, Harry Huxley claimed a cure for cancer. Herbal formulas inherited from his great-grandfather. Thousands of patients swore the treatment cured them. But the medical authorities branded Huxley the worst crack of the century. And so began a medical war continuing to this day. In a moment, our special show guest tonight, Kenny Ossibel, right here on Coast to Coast AM. What an incredible guest we have for you tonight on Coast to Coast. Kenny Ossibel is an award-winning writer, filmmaker, social entrepreneur. He's the visionary founder of Bioneers, a nationally acclaimed environmental group focused on nature-based solutions and social innovations for healing people and the planet. The annual Bioneers Conference draws more than 3,000 people in California, 10,000 more to 20 live satellite conferences around the country. Kenny also co-founded Seeds of Change, now the nation's leading organic seed biodiversify company. And Kenny was a central advisor to and appears in Leonardo DiCaprio's new feature documentary about the environment called The 11th Hour. And Kenny has promised to try to get Leonardo on the program one day. Huh, Kenny? You're going to do that for us?
Well, I'll do what I can. But, you know, he's a busy guy.
I know. You just make the request. That's all I ask for.
I will do that.
How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Good. Beyond the bio, tell me a little bit about Kenny Ossibel.
Well, let's see. I live in the mountains outside Santa Fe with my wife and a couple of dogs, and I'm very concerned about the state of the world, so I'm doing everything I can, you know.
What kind of dogs do you have?
Pound puppies, you know. Tried to save a couple of dogs' lives.
Good for you. I admire people who do that. You know, you don't have to own an animal, but you should love one, because some people don't have the time or the resources to take care of one properly. But I got to tell you, doing what you do, saving a couple animals from, you know, the fate, that's pretty darn good, Ken.
Well, if you want unconditional love, get a dog, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to spend a lot of time talking about Harry Huxley tonight with you, and then some of the other things that you've been involved with. But tell me, how did you get involved in what we're going to be talking about tonight, this interest in, the environment, in health? What happened?
Well, I had two very, very personal experiences. The first one was when I was in college. I was about 20 years old. And I woke up one morning partially paralyzed on the left side of my body, and I couldn't see straight, and I couldn't swallow, and I felt like I'd been hit in the back of the head with a baseball bat, and felt like I had the hangover from hell. And I had no idea what had happened. I was totally terrified and traumatized and, you know, didn't know what was going on. And I ended up going to all these doctors, and none of them were able to diagnose it at all. In fact, mostly they started asking what my draft status was. You know? This was the late 60s.
Yeah.
And And I thought I was going to die, actually, for quite a number of years. And I ended up moving out west. I had grown up in New York City and moved to a small farm outside Santa Fe to try to recover my health. And long story short, what I ultimately discovered was I had had a massive poisoning of some kind from some sort of environmental toxin, possibly dioxin. And that, you know, the doctors were totally not able to help me. And out of desperation as a patient, you know, I sort of fell through the rabbit hole into the world of alternative medicine. And that was before it even had a name. You know, I first tried to get acupuncture in New York City. It was still illegal. I was going to go underground in Chinatown to get acupuncture, you know. And so anyway, obviously that made me very conscious about the environment. And I learned all kinds of stuff about natural medicine and began on a long, gradual path of healing that, you know, really alternative medicine saved my life. And in the midst of my own drama, when I was, you know, in the first few years of this, living on this small organic farm in northern New Mexico, I got a call from my mom one night in New York City, who told me that my father had cancer. And 6 months later, at the age of 56, he was dead.
Oh.
And I was totally traumatized by this and, you know, really shocked. And about 2 weeks after his death, unbidden in the mail, I got this newsletter that had all these testimonials from terminal cancer patients who were given up to die, you know, by their doctors, and then they got well using this, you know, quack therapy, basically. And I was pretty skeptical, even despite everything I'd been learning myself. You know, I kind of believed what the doctors told me about cancer, which it's largely incurable, and the only people who got well did it with surgery and radiation and chemotherapy. And so I read these testimonials, and, you know, I've been a writer and a journalist for a long time, and I'm curious as an individual. So I decided, you know, with my heart broken, and, you know, if there was anything at all to this, I really wanted to know about it. And so I embarked on about 2 or 3 years of pretty intensive research, and it was kind of through the looking glass. You know, I just began to find one after another story of people that Dr. Bernie Siegel from Yale calls people who got well when they weren't supposed to. And they did it by every means you can imagine. I mean, everything under the sun and moon, but there was no question that they were supposed to die and they got well. And about 2.5 years into my research, I came across the story of Harry Hoxie. And suddenly a light bulb went off in my head because really what I understood from reading the story of Hoxie was that, like everything else, medicine is political. And, you know, this guy, Harry Hoxie, had come up with what appeared to be a very successful herbal treatment for cancer and ended up in a 35-year medical civil war with first the AMA and then Uncle Sam, you know, the Food and Drug.
Oh, yeah, they were after. Well, he inherited this from his great-grandfather, right?
Well, you know, it's called
some of the formulas.
Yeah, George, it's called the wildest story in medical history. And, you know, Mark Twain could have written this. I mean, it's so out there.
All right, everyone, sit back and listen to this, because we have talked about alternative medicine and treatments, and I'm a huge believer in this, Kenny. I think there's some tremendous doctors in this country who are trying to help people. I think some pharmaceuticals help people, but I also think, by and large, that this planet, through natural ways, has an incredible ability to take care of us. And, you know, you'll hear a little bit more about where I'm coming from tonight, because I do believe alternative medicine is critically important for people's health. This is a story that is absolutely astounding. So tell us a little bit about Harry Hoxie, and then go back a little bit. How did the great-grandfather get some of this?
Well, I spent about 4 years researching this, and became basically sort of the world authority on Harry Hoxie and the whole story. But some of it is impossible to document, and much of it is not. I was able to document, you know, a huge amount of the story. But the legend, which no one really knows the truth, was that, well, Harry was the youngest of 8 children. He was born in southern Illinois, and his father was a veterinarian, actually. But Hoxie's grandfather had been a horse farmer in southern Illinois in 1840, and his prize stallion got a malignant tumor on its right hock. And being a Quaker, he didn't want to shoot the horse, so he just put it out to pasture to die peacefully. And about 3 weeks later, he noticed that the tumor had stabilized. And so he started to observe the horse very, very closely, and within about 3 months, the tumor was really on its way out. And within a year, the horse was completely well. So during this time, he observed the horse very, very closely, and what he discovered was that it was eating all these unusual plants, not part of its normal diet, mostly roots and barks. And so old Farmer Hoxie went out in the barn with his mortar and pestle and started to experiment on these herbs that were literally discovered by horse sense.
Had no experience in pharmacology at all, did he?
Well, you know what's so interesting, George, is there's now a whole branch of medicine. They have a big department at Harvard. It's called zoopharmacognosy. And Jane Goodall has done a lot of work in this area with chimpanzees.
That's right. Stay with us, Kenny. We're going to take this quick break. We'll come back with you, and we'll continue this incredible story of Harry Hoxie and his family. Tonight is the night. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Those of you renewing your After Dark subscription, and those of you who are going to be brand new subscribers, you get a free CD, Art Bell's old interview with Al Bielek on the Philadelphia Experiment, when you order or renew by calling 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online, coasttocoastam.com. Makes a great gift. CD's fantastic. And also, part of the proceeds go to Mr. Al Bielek of the Philadelphia Experiment. Main guest, Kenny Acevalla, started earlier, so we'll do our open lines later on at the end of the program, and also we'll give you an opportunity to talk with him as well. Okay, Kenny, so we'll talk about the horse. The great-grandfather somehow sees the horse eating these unusual plants, and he starts to mix this stuff up himself.
You bet. And, you know, as I mentioned, there's a whole school of pharmacy now, based of science, based around exactly this fact. Jane Goodall has proven it with chimpanzees in Africa who self-medicate. So the animals have very strong instincts. And I live in the Southwest, and I have a lot of Native American friends. And when I told them this story, they kind of looked at me and they said, well, what do you think we did? Went out and tasted every plant and hoped it didn't kill us? We watched the animals. You know, so it's a very ancient tradition.
How did the horse know what to eat?
Because instinctively it knew. That's what we need to be studying, right?
You know,
as you said earlier, George, there's an incredible healing power in nature if we just know where to look and pay attention.
I think so, too. Okay, so he mixes this up. Then what's he do with it?
Well, he became very famous as a veterinarian. He worked for Ringling Brothers Circus treating animals with cancer and tumors and became quite famous. And he passed these formulas down through the generations, and Harry Hoxie's father was the first one to try it on people, and he repeatedly got positive results. And when Harry was quite young, he was 15 years old, his father had an untimely accident and was on his deathbed. And Harry had, as a child, developed a real sort of passion for healing. He just had a feeling for it.
Yeah.
He worked with his dad for years. And so on his dad's deathbed, he bequeathed the formulas to him, which he had kept secret. And in the course of this transmission, he told young Harry that as a Quaker, he always had to treat poor people for free, you know, rich or poor, whether or not you could pay. And he warned him, he prophesied to watch out for the high priests of medicine who would fight him tooth and nail if he tried to bring this into the world. And he told the boy, go to medical school and try to become a doctor. And so he gave him these formulas and made him memorize them and then burn up the actual paper with the formulas on them, you know. And that's when Harry, he at that time was working in the coal mines, and he was kind of an interesting, kind of a Baron von Munchausen character. He played semi-pro ball for three different baseball teams under different names, and he sold insurance and tried to put himself through college. And then one dark, stormy night, there was a knock on his door, and this guy showed up that he remembered from his childhood, who was an old Civil War veteran who was dying of cancer. And he begged Harry to treat him. And Harry said, you know, I can't. I'm going to go to medical school. I'll get in trouble and I'll get blackballed. And the guy said, well, you know, if you don't heal me, you're going to kill me. I mean, are you a murderer? So Harry swore him to secrecy and treated him. And the guy got well.
Oh, my.
And before he knew it, he had more people showing up on his door. Word spread. And in 1924, he opened the first Hoxie Cancer Clinic in southern Illinois. And that's when things got really interesting.
Now, whereabouts in southern Illinois? Because, you know, I'm in L.A. now, but I'm also in St. Louis at any given time. That must be pretty close.
Yeah, I was in Taylorville, not far away.
Know it well. Know it very well. As a matter of fact, I had a horse farm near Taylorville.
Wow.
I would be amazed. No, it can't be. I would be amazed if the great-grandfather's horse farm was the one I ended up buying a long time ago from
Winnipeg.
Wow,
you never know.
Boy, that would be too strange.
Destiny, huh?
Now I have to check into it.
So what happened was his fame spread very, very quickly. You know, at first he was backed by the Chamber of Commerce of Taylorville, who thought they'd become the cancer capital of the world. I mean, who would oppose a cure for cancer, right? And so Chicago, of course, was close by, which was the headquarters of the newly powerful American Medical Association.
Mm-hmm. And very powerful indeed.
Very powerful, and headed by Dr. Morris Fishbein, who was the head of the AMA Journal, which became the tail that wagged the dog because it was such a profitable publication, because they controlled, they were the gatekeepers to advertising into all medical products, right? Which had to be approved by the medical.
Absolutely. First of all, they didn't have television then. And in that era, once radio started, I don't think they were allowing pharmaceutical ads, were they?
Well, sure. In the 1920s, that was what they built their whole thing on, was basically advertising.
Yeah, just for the magazine, but I mean not on radio or anything like that.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah, no, exactly right. Yeah.
All right, so in your book, which you call When Healing Becomes a Crime, what happened? Something happened.
Well, something happened, indeed, and here's where we know some and we don't know some, but the stories diverge. But what we do know, and I spent, as I say, years and years researching this, and I got into the archives of the AMA itself, and they saved every scrap of paper. They have incredible files, so I was able to document a huge amount of this. But basically, he was invited to Chicago to a very reputable hospital to demonstrate his treatment on a terminal patient. And I found photographs, before and after pictures and all the medical records, a police sergeant who had a huge lethal tumor on his shoulder. And Hoxie treated the man successfully. And shortly after, he held a demonstration where he actually removed this dead tumor from this patient, who lived on for another 20 years and testified on Hoxie's behalf in trials. He was invited into a back room of the AMA, where he was offered a contract for the rights to his formulas. And this we do not know. I mean, this is what Hoxie says. The AMA denies it, of course. But whatever happened, that's when the battle started. And Hoxie basically asked that poor people be treated for free, and he wanted the Hoxie name on it, which his father had asked him to do. And, of course, that didn't fly. And some kind of, fight occurred, and Hoxie refused to sell them the formula. And that's when the battle started. And for the next 35 years, organized medicine went after him tooth and nail. And Hoxie won all the battles, only to finally lose the war 35 years later.
What did they do to him ultimately, Kenny?
Well, ultimately, they could never get him, except on a technicality, which was that because he was a layperson, he became a naturopath, but he didn't have a medical degree. They claimed that he could not own a clinic that treated patients, and that was how they finally shut him down. But he won the most astonishing sequence of court trials, including two federal courts that upheld the therapeutic value of the treatment.
And not until he moved to Tijuana, right?
Yeah, finally they shut him down in this country in 1960, but during that time, he had clinics in 17 states, but his main clinic, the headquarters, was in Dallas, Texas, and they had 12,000 patients in the middle of the 1950s. And just to give you a sense of scale, today the two biggest cancer treatment centers in the country, Sloan Kettering and MD Anderson, each have about 13,000 patients. So it was huge, huge, and very, very famous.
Is it still operating?
Well, yeah, his chief nurse, Mildred Nelson, whom I got to know very, very well, I made a film before I wrote the book, she took it to Tijuana in 1963, and they were actually the granddaddy of all the alternative clinics. They were the first one to go south of the border.
I've seen this on HBO.
Yeah, the film actually played in movie theaters in about a dozen cities, and then it made HBO in 1988, and it got the highest viewer response of any documentary that ever shown at that time.
Now, you have in the book, When Healing Becomes a Crime, the formula. How, first of all, do you believe that's the formula?
Well, there's a lot of question about it, but yes, more or less, that's the formula. And what my research turned up was that, you have to remember, Illinois at that time was the Western frontier. And so they were right in Indian country. And it turns out virtually all of these herbs were old Native American plants for cancer. So it's very likely that they were influenced. There was a lot of folk medicine at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an old naturopathic formula that's very, very similar to the Hoxie formula. So whether they discovered it independently or, there was just a flow of information, going on at that time, we don't know. But I did a tremendous amount of research on the plants, on the herbs. And all of the herbs are anti-tumor, anti-cancer agents and immune boosters and, purgatives and it basically, after many, many years, the film had a pretty big impact in Washington, D.C., and ultimately led to the National Institutes of Health actually sending some researchers to the last remaining Hoxie clinic in Tijuana around 1999. And they looked at six bulletproof cases of terminal patients who should have died, who did no treatment besides Hoxie, and who got well, including lung cancer and melanoma, which are virtually incurable.
That's fantastic. Now, the formula now, is it the same formula as what he had then?
As far as we know, more or less, yeah.
Because I've been doing some research into all this because it's a hobby of mine. And if I have a hobby, raspberry powder, for example, is being touted now as a great anti-cancer type alternative. And he doesn't have that in his formula. I wonder if he were alive today, if he would adjust that formula somewhat.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, as far as I could tell, they more or less stuck with this. For most, they refined it a little bit near the beginning, but I think they stuck with it after that. And, what was very interesting to me was to see, because by the 1940s and 1950s, Hoxie wasn't just using the internal tonic. He was advocating a healthy diet and organic food, by the 1950s, which was unheard of. And he also talked about attitudinal healing. He said that hope is a healing agent, and that when you take away hope, people die. And that's now proven scientifically. We know the role that hope plays. So he was so far ahead of the curve, in retrospect, 50, 60 years ago, to be doing this stuff.
Well, it's I'm glad at least those clinics continue out there. There's another one. There's Bryomed. There's an organization also in Tijuana. I have a feeling offshoots of Hoxie's formula are popping up all over Mexico now.
It could well be, and they've also had a lot of success with animals, actually. People bring their pets, They don't promote that because it would be, very hard to handle that many people coming with animals. But I know people who have used it on pets and had success with that, too. So, there's no placebo effect when you're talking about your dog or something.
Kenny, the push of mainstream medicine to something like what Hoxie has done is incredibly aggressive. I mean, they want to shut you down. They want to stop it. Why? Why is it because the pharmaceutical companies are making so much money in research and doing what they're doing? Why are they after the alternative people so much?
Well, you're going right to the heart of the most important questions, George. And I spent years asking myself that same question. And I think there's two main things going on here. One of them is that Hoxie was basically born up against the golden age of the corporatization of medicine, of big bucks, which, medicine never had been profitable before that time. And it became this giant industry. So there's no question that money and power were at the heart of it. And, these are herbs you can grow in your backyard, and you can't patent them. And the whole drug industry, of course, is built on patents, which are legal monopolies, basically. So certainly there was a huge financial factor involved. But the other thing is there's much deeper roots. There's actually a medical civil war going back centuries that's a conflict of medical philosophy. And conventional medicine, called allopathic medicine, comes from a tradition called heroic medicine. And the basic belief was that the body has no ability to cure itself, and the doctor has to be this heroic figure who intervenes very aggressively with very dangerous and often toxic treatments in order to kill the disease before they kill the patient, right? Whereas Hoxie was from the natural medicine tradition, and the fundamental belief was that nature has this incredible power of healing, and that really the role of the doctor or the healer is to facilitate the body to cure itself, usually using all kinds of natural remedies.
Sure.
And so there's a really deep philosophical split there. And you have to remember, in the 19th century, they were giving people mercury to cure syphilis,
Yeah.
Yeah. And not just syphilis. I mean, in the 1850s, the rate of young American men who couldn't get into the military was just off the charts because they all had mercury poisoning from their doctors. I mean, so this is what was going on in the conventional world.
Now, if somebody that you knew had cancer, would you send them to an oncologist, or would you say, I've got this Hoxie formula, I'm going to send you to Tijuana, or I'm going to make this for you? What would you do?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of time with cancer patients, and it's a very serious, deadly disease, and you need to take it really seriously. And I think from the point of view of a patient, you want all options open to you, and you want the best of all worlds. You don't care if it's conventional, if it's alternative. What you want is something that's going to work.
Yes.
And the truth is, the problem with a lot of the alternatives is simply that the research hasn't been done, and so there's not good data. It's hard to get good information, and that's a real problem. That's why it's encouraging now, because there's a lot more science being done on all these things. But I think it really, really depends on the type of cancer you have. It depends on your belief system, what you feel comfortable with, you know. And then it's a matter of personal choice. And at the end of the day, it's also a medical civil rights issue. I mean, it's your body and your life. And if you want to go one direction, who's going to tell you not to do that? So I think it really depends on the specific case. But I've seen a lot of people get well from Hoxie. And Hoxie himself always said it wasn't a panacea or a magic bullet or a cure-all. And they didn't cure every case by any means. But there's a whole host of alternatives now that are increasingly well-documented that do work in many, many cases. So I believe in what Dr. Andrew Weil talks about of integrative medicine, of the best of all worlds.
Sure. Well, when it did work in Hoxie's case, and I think he was recommending like a teaspoon of it, you know, every once in a while of this mixture, this formula. When it did work, how quickly did it take effect? How quickly did it start attacking this tumor or building the immune system which attacked it?
Well, you know, it really depends on how advanced the cancer is, a lot of factors. But, you know, usually within 6 months, you begin to see pretty significant recovery. And within a year or two, ordinarily, people got well. There's a difference, too, between what, you know, internal cancers and external cancers as well. They have a separate treatment for the external, which includes melanoma, which is both internal and external. But even the AMA itself ultimately admitted in 1949 that Hoxie's external treatments do work, and they never contested it since that time. And it's quite serious. I mean, a lot of people have, you know, especially with the hole in the ozone layer and everything else, there's a lot of skin cancer.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And it's very quick. A friend of mine is a dermatologist, and he says, George, you can't believe the cases that I see. Somebody comes in with what could be just a small little nodule on his body. It turns out to be a melanoma, and the guy dies in 6 months.
That's right. And it's even more vicious these days with environmental, you know, destruction and toxicity. But it's very interesting. I did all the research. You know, one of the things that they said, for 35 years, Hoxie tried to get a fair scientific investigation, right? He even put up his own money.
He wanted it researched, didn't he?
Desperately wanted it. It was what his whole life was about. And they simply refused to test it. They said, we know it doesn't work, and so we're not going to test it. Well, that's not science. That's theology, you know? And what was very interesting to me was to do the research on conventional cancer treatments. And it turns out that most of them are untested. In fact, when they first started testing radiation therapy, so-called therapy, they found that untreated patients lived 4 times longer, so they stopped the tests. You know, we know with chemotherapy, according to Scientific American, that it's effective at most against 2 to 3% of cancers. I mean, yet it's given to 4 out of 5 patients. So what is that? You know, so I'm all for science. Believe me, I'd love to see good data on all this stuff and let the chips fall where they may. That's what science is about, is dispassionate, objective evaluation.
God forbid, if you needed this kind of treatment, would you get a Hoxie type potion to fix yourself?
Well, I probably would. You know, I mean, it really depends. There are cases particularly where surgery is really appropriate treatment, and I think it's the best of the lot. There are certain types of cancer that do respond to chemotherapy, as brutal as the treatment is. Radiation, I don't think, has much of a place except maybe to slow down a tumor that's growing incredibly fast.
Yeah.
But one of the problems that I saw and that they talked about at the Hoxie Clinic was that because treatments, all the natural treatments, including Hoxie, work to stimulate the immune system, if you've already had chemotherapy, you don't have much of an immune system left. And so I think oftentimes it makes sense to go first to the alternative and use conventional treatments as a last resort.
And get monitored, see how things are going.
You bet. And I believe in the best of all worlds, so I wouldn't rule anything out. I would try to get really good information and then, you know, decide for myself what I really felt was the best path for me. You know, one of the really interesting things, too, is they always said that all these poor, gullible idiots that came to Hoxie were ignorant and poorly informed. And there's been all this big, you know, they were basically victims, right? And there's all this research now about who uses alternative cancer treatments. And, you know, the huge majority of people are college educated, really well informed, have done a ton of research, and they're really well informed, smart people.
All right. Well, stay with us, Kenny. We'll be back with you in just a moment. We'll talk about how you ended up starting Seeds of Change. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie.